Do you recall a day where everything clicked into place, where the world seemed to move in perfect harmony and every task flowed effortlessly? Introducing you to London Nootropics, adaptogenic coffee blends, thoughtfully crafted to elevate and balance your day, delivering all the perks of your beloved coffee, plus the incredible benefits of adaptogens, which also help to dial down those less than loved side effects like jitters, anxiety, and that all too familiar crash. A premium mix of medicinal mushroom extracts and other potent adaptogens, each blend is targeted for a specific purpose depending on what you need. Flow enhances your mental clarity and focus. Zen is your go-to for stress relief and balance. And Mojo offers that clean, natural energy lift. It's the synergy between caffeine and adaptogens that works wonders, allowing us to relish the caffeine buzz without the drawbacks, ensuring a smooth, sustained energy flow. My top pick is the Zen blend. It's a lifesaver for those of us who are caffeine sensitive, and not to mention comes in the most charming packaging. So why not elevate your coffee experience with London Nootropics? Discover the perfect blend, find your flow, and enjoy an exclusive 20% discount with the code SaturnReturns at londonnootropics.com. Hello everyone, and welcome to Saturn Returns with me, Kaggy Dunlop. This is a podcast that aims to bring clarity during transitional times where there can be confusion and doubt. In today's episode, I am joined by a very dear friend of mine, and that is Sarah Macklin. Sarah started her journey in the modeling industry, and she is now an established nutritionist. She is the founder of an organization called the Be Well Collective, and she is the host of the Live Well, Be Well podcast. In this conversation, Sarah discusses her journey in the modeling industry, starting out at just the age of 15. After being scouted at a music festival, she was catapulted into the fashion world, which I think we always believe is a very glamorous one from the outside. So she shares some of her insights into the reality of what that world was actually like. She shares how she got into nutrition and health and wellness, which essentially started firstly with her own personal health scare and then one for her father. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
Welcome to the Saturn Returns podcast.
I am so excited to be here.
It's been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been about 4 years.
Well, for the audience that doesn't know, obviously, you're one of my dearest friends, but would you be able to introduce yourself in your own words?
I'd love to. So apart from being one of Kag's dearest friends, I am the host of a podcast as well. So we are both on our podcast journey together. Mm-hmm. It is called Live Well, Be Well, and it's a mix of my seven pillars of health. It's entwined with storytelling, which I believe is one of the most important areas of any change in health behavior, linked with the leading scientists around the world on kind of studies that are coming out surrounding mental health, physical well-being, emotional well-being, and combining all of that together into kind of your own health journey. So that's the show Live Well, Be Well that we have on, similar to Saturn Returns, and on YouTube, which we've taken on this year, which feels...
Yeah, it's a beast.
Quite a bit of a beast. And alongside that, I'm a registered nutritionist. And I've been in that field now for, crikey, nearly 10 years. And I also have a mental health organization, which you know really well, called the Be Well Collective. And I set that up 5 years ago. I founded that. And we started off within the fashion industry, because that was part of my history of where I kind of started my whole journey in the fashion industry as a model. And so we basically built this independent, not-for-profit organization, one, to help create structure, mental health structure, support and advice within the fashion industry, because in the whole history of the fashion industry, there's never been any support. And then that extended more to creatives, working in the music industry, working... In the film, we did a lot with Netflix. And then when COVID hit, which was a really pivotal part for us, everybody, like the whole nation, well, the whole globe basically started connecting with their mental health. And
pausing this for a moment because I've got something exciting to share. Today's episode is brought to you by London Nootropics, the masters of crafting adaptogenic coffee blends that don't just taste heavenly, but they also boost your energy the right way. Now we all love that zesty kick from caffeine. It snaps us awake by outsmarting those sleepy adenosine receptors in our brain. But here's the kicker. Caffeine can hike up our cortisol, giving us the jitters or anxiety, particularly if you're like me and caffeine sensitive. But that's where the magic of adaptogen steps in. These natural heroes level out our cortisol, smoothing the energy boost from caffeine without the downsides. Plus, while caffeine tends to rush in and fade away, leaving you crashing, adaptogens extend that energy, keeping you vibrant without reaching for another cup. So if you want to find your most productive self with Lion's Mane and Rhodiola in their flow blend, Cordyceps in Mojo is known to increase our aerobic capacity, oxygen flow, and boost ATP. So it's perfect before a run or workout or when you're feeling fatigued. So if you're intrigued and you want to dive deeper into their blend secrets and discover which adaptogens sync with you, try visiting their website. And because you're part of the Saturn Returns family, enjoy a special 20% off at London Nootropics Adaptogenic Coffee with the code SaturnReturns. Enjoy.
I think before then, mental health was only looked at from the lens of mental illness, which was a very stigmatized lens. But now mental health feels like a much more open concept. And everybody started to connect to stress, to loneliness. All of these are factors that kind of harm our mental health. And so we had a huge influx to our sites in COVID, which basically allowed us to extend our help to more people. So now Be Well do a lot within the creative industry, but we just do a lot nationwide now as well. I try to sum up, which I know you do, Cags, as well. It's like really hard to kind of pinpoint this like one thing that we do, but it's a lot about communicating, storytelling, and disseminating kind of that sometimes very scientific structured advice into accessible, empowering information, because that's what really kind of transformed my health journey. Because before any of this, this is when we met each other, when I was, I don't know, 19.
I always forget that we met, yeah.
So young.
And then we didn't see each other.
And then we didn't see each other for ages. Decade. And then we became really close and our paths went back to help me mode. But I was in the fashion industry.
Yeah. Working full time as a model then?
Full time, yeah, full time. And
you had a huge amount. I mean, you still are very successful as a model. What was that experience like? Because I know from the outside, it's always very glamorized. Yeah. And I know I've met so many models in my life and I've always thought it looks like quite an appealing industry, but then the more I hear about it, I'm like, ooh. And also I would say that perhaps the most beautiful women I've ever met in my entire life often are the ones that are the most insecure because, yeah. You know, by the nature of the job, they are being put against one another, being sort of pulled apart and pinched and shoved and scrutinized. Yeah. And therefore, inevitably, it gives you a bit of a complex. So
totally.
Firstly, like, let's tap into that part of your career a little bit and what that journey was like. Because I know that that opened, not necessarily opened the doors, but led you to the path that you're on now.
It did. Do you know what? Because I came from just like a really small town where none of this industry was accessible. And then all of a sudden...
You were from Portsmouth?
Yeah, literally like 1 mile outside. Like there's a place called Portsdown Hill, which is where I'm from. And literally, this just does not happen to where people I'm from. I had no concept that I would ever go into the modeling world. I loved photography, wanted to go and study that, be on the other side of the lens. Never in a million years would think I'd be alongside the photographers that I shot against. And then all of a sudden, I was at a pot festival. And I think it was like one of my first times I was allowed out on my own. I was 15. I went to this big pop concert. I loved Blue. Went to go and watch them.
Never and admit that.
No, I admit that. I remember being this like 15 years old and being like, gosh, this is like the best moment. And I went and I remember there was like six of us and one of my friends was insanely tall as well. And so when I got this tap, I actually thought, oh, no, you mean her? And they were like, no, we're talking to you. I kind of couldn't even like get my head around that somebody would say that to me. I don't know if you remember this, but like my mum was always like, don't speak to strangers. It's really weird when the first time you're allowed out to this pot festival and everyone's like giving you their business cards and you're like, is this real? And I went home and showed my mum and she was like, yeah, these are real agencies in London. I was like, really?
Which agency was it?
So it was Select, Storm, and Models One.
All of them.
And IMG, yeah.
All of them scouted you
on that day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's basically like when any big pop concerts are going on. And this is going back like 15 years ago.
Which is the only way. So it's pre-social media.
It's pre-social media. They'd all go to Topshop on Oxford Street, which is now not there. And they'd all go to like these different pop festivals. So some in Hyde Park and some on the South Coast. And like anything that T4 did, they would go there. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I got scouted and I went up. And I remember Henry Holland was my first ever casting. And I'd walked into the agency. I ended up going with Select because I knew my brother knew Daisy Lowe, who was signed as a model back then. And she said, oh, I'm with Select. I trust them. So I went with her advice. And went to go and see Henry Holland, and he was really sweet. And I walked out, I was like, oh God, they hate me. They absolutely hate me. And then 10 seconds later, I'm walking down the road and my agent was like, you've got the job. And that was like the start of trying to understand how this industry works. And you're so young at that age. I don't know if you remember what you were like when you were 16, but you don't really have that emotional capacity to really understand. So on the outside, I obviously looked into this industry as this kind of amazing sphere of success and things that I could be catapulted into, which is what happened. But that does come at a massive cost because there was no infrastructure to support my mental health or how I looked. And what I had to really quickly learn was every single job that I went to, for me, leaned on financial success. So every time there was a no, I didn't get paid. Every time I didn't get booked, I didn't get paid. So the pressure of being accepted for what you look like is huge. And then you're also on that trajectory at that age of all of your friends are going to university. They're starting to form these big bonds. And I was on a plane, on a train, in a hotel, just totally on my own. And I back then, the concept of loneliness just wasn't spoken about at all. Because you'd have your phones, but you didn't have social media or anything like that. That still wasn't around. And so I barely saw my friends and family because I was just flying all the time. And they get to a point when you're meeting a new team every day. Half the time they don't speak the language. They're speaking a different language on the side of you. And you just feel really removed. Mm-hmm. And so you're really self-conscious. And I think that's why some of the biggest models are the most insecure. Because it's like every day you're going to an interview. Sometimes you're going to an interview 10 times a day to maybe be rejected directly to your face on something that you just can't change. And that pressure mounts up because you start getting a taste for that success. And I think that's why a lot of models can get quite caught, or anyone in that kind of industry, because it's something that it's so hard to know if you're ever going to make it. And for me, I have so much gratitude for my career that I managed to do and the success that I built. But I remember living in New York and just feeling so removed and living in a model apartment, which sounds really glamorous, and it really wasn't. It was like mice infested. We were paying like through the roof. We were sharing rooms. And some of these were like the biggest girls in New York. You know, it's not like none of these people were. They have like huge names, but you were always in and out. So you know, you wouldn't know where you would be living, what country you'd be in. And the pressure was so immense. And you were around this like ecosystem of really poor mental health. You didn't really have any kind of role model or structure or support at all. It was just all of it was an ecosystem of kind of a poor mental health bubbling pot.
And when you say poor mental health, what do you mean by that? What does that actually look like?
So it's like a whole range of things. So it would be things from eating disorders, like mm-hmm. eating disorders are rife in our industry for copious amounts of reasons. You're signed when you're 16, and then by the time you're 21 and you've got hips, you've still got to be competing with 16-year-old girls, mm-hmm. but you're given no nutritional guidance, no nutritional support. And if you think about a normal 21-year-old girl that's not a model, they still suffer with complexities around body shape and body size and body dissatisfaction and comparison. But you're so heightened when you're in that industry, so you're hyper aware all the time, and you're also competing with the people you're living with, which I think is
pretty unhealthy.
Really unhealthy environment. So it's like everything's on steroids when you're in that industry. And then you've got depression. Like lots of girls really suffered with like severe depression just from the enormity of the pressure that was on people's shoulders. Anxiety, like never knowing where you'd be one day to the next, not having a support structure around you. That's something that I suffered really, really badly with, was anxiety. I mean, if you can just kind of think of like somebody who has a very kind of healthy mental health structure, I kind of want to say, is somebody who might have these moments of anxiety or might have these moments of self-doubt, but it doesn't consume them. But you were just consumed with that all the time. You know, every single person around us, it was like on steroids that we'd be around. So we never kind of, I would never go home and see my friends because I was in a different country.
Yeah.
So having that kind of, that groundedness was never really there. And I think then a couple of years of me living in New York, you're also around people that are 15, 20 years older than you, that you're going to work with every day. So you're in this, you know, New York is, I found it so much faster than Europe.
Yeah.
It's like on steroids. And so you're just not really getting a chance to think. And so, yeah, kind of mixing that. And then I remember a couple of years after Instagram launched, and that was like a whole other level of comparison. And then the wellness culture, which for somebody who is needing to like look their best and be their best, obviously gets completely sucked into this side of things. And I remember trying all of these different kind of wellness, healthy alternatives that actually just made me not in a very healthy state, because I would not be feeding my body correctly. I'd be putting more stress on me. I'd be feeling more anxious. And it was just basically a recipe for disaster. And I see that still now, this mm-hmm. kind of wellness culture. It's marketed in a really poor way, I think. And it's not done by people that know what they're talking about. And I think when you're looking for answers or wanting to look better, feel better, all of these things, you can be really sucked into it. It's like a void. And I was really sucked into it. And that's when, you know, kind of my whole pivot came, because at that point, my whole body just kind of gave up on me.
And what did that look like?
I remember being 23 and I came back to the UK and I was shooting American Vintage. And I woke up in the morning and I had like a severe temperature. And it's one of those things that I never ever signed in sick. I never called my agent. I was like, I can't make a shoot, because you've got like 50 people waiting on set mm-hmm. for you. So if you don't turn up, not only do you mess everyone's day up, but the whole campaign goes out the window and you're kind of looked at as, you know, unprofessional.
You won't be
booked again. So I remember going, and I remember taking Nurofen on the way. And I had this excruciating back pain. And I was just like, what is going on? So I took more and I took more and nothing was numbing it. And then when I finished that shoot, and I remember it was, oh God, I remember that shoot because there was another girl and she got sent home. And they were like, oh no, you're going to now do all of the looks. And it was that one day we were just thinking, I just don't know if I can get through this day. And so I remember having like double the workload, got home and collapsed. My housemate was in at the time, called an ambulance, ended up in A&E. A couple of hours later, I was in intensive care, and they didn't know what happened. And basically after 24 hours, they took me down to a CAT scan. I was internally bleeding inside. And what happened was that my kidney had stopped. I had sepsis all through my body. I was riddled with E. coli. I'd had 5 burst cysts. My whole body had just completely stopped working. And I think that was what the terrifying thing was, because when they picked me up in the ambulance, it's not a seizure, but I can't pronounce it properly. It's like Raygor's, I think it is, where my kidney was flushing everything back out because it was starting to fail. So my body was going into what was like a seizure.
A convulsions.
And I probably had that like 7 times before I got into intensive care. And I remember the whole kind of mixture of this was, I think, like such intense stress. Like people talk about a lot about burnout now. That's called like, that's on the spectrum of like habitual burnout, where your whole body just literally completely stops. And Gabor Mate talks a lot about this in his books, with how stress manifests in the body. And it's something that I learned at 23 from having this like 6 years of buildup of just suppression and trying to cope. And my whole body just completely stopped. But the weird thing is, like, that wasn't my, you would think that moment would be my wake up call,
like a rock bottom,
but it wasn't. That is what I look back on and go, how the hell did I not go, wake up, something's wrong? I remember going back to New York and I was cycling around Hyde Park with a friend of mine, and my phone kept ringing. And I remember my mum always says that she's just someone who, like, if you don't answer the phone, she just keeps calling you until you answer. Doesn't really get, you know, someone's busy, but she just kept calling. But this was like 10 times, which is call, call, call. And I was like, what's going on? So I answered her. I was like, mum, I'm just like cycling. Can I call you back? And she was like, your dad's had a brain hemorrhage and you need to get home. And I remember being like, it was probably the first point in about 6 years. And this is, I think, what still really hits me. It was the first point in 6 years where I had a feeling in my body, because I was like, is he okay? And my mum was like, I don't know. And I remember being like not knowing how to deal with it, but just having this like really intense emotion through my body. And I think that was something that really jerked me, because I don't think I'd felt anything for so long. I think I completely numbed myself into survival mode, into just working as hard as I could, proving myself as much as I could, all of those things. And my dad is literally like one of my best friends. Like I adore him. And I remember there was probably like a huge like void of sadness in that, because I hadn't spent much time with my family because I'd been in New York and I'd been striving for this life. And I had no idea what values meant. I had no idea what purpose. I had no idea of any of these things. Like I literally just went straight into the modeling world and just tried to survive. But knowing back now, that's something that obviously I'd been really missing. Mm-hmm. The strangest thing is that I nearly lost my life. It didn't wake me up, but I nearly lost my father, and that's what woke me up. And I remember calling my agent in New York, so not in London, and saying, I need to get on a flight. I need to get on a flight now. And I'd booked a really, really big job the next day. And I remember like the fee and the photographer and kind of the vastness of this job. And it was something that I'd been wanting for about a year. And my agent was like, well, you've got this really big job tomorrow. You know, sure. Why don't you go the day after? And just that like conversation with something where you're fighting in your body to be like, I need to go home to see someone who might not be alive when I touch down. Like when we, honestly, he was like rushed into intensive care. Everyone was like, we don't know if he's going to make it back out. So then having this complicated conversation of like, do I stay and shoot? Like having that moment made me realize actually how much I'd put towards this and completely disassociated anything I needed from myself.
And also how sort of out of whack the values were.
Completely, but on both sides, like mm-hmm. realizing for the first time that I guess like when you're growing up in that industry, you look at those people as a bit of a mentor and you kind of hope that they would go, right, all action stations, let's get you on a flight. What can we do? How can we look after you?
And that wasn't.
And it wasn't there. And I think that really made me, I remember like just being like, I'm getting on a plane. And then that month, my New York agency were like, I don't know if you're going to be spending much time here. You know, you seem to be kind of preoccupied, and they dropped me. And it was that moment where I was like, yeah, you know,
a bit of a wake up.
All of that wake up. And I remember sitting with my dad, and I remember the consultant. I mean, he was in a really bad space about 2 years after that. And it completely changed him as a person. But I remember the consultant coming in and saying, the reason why your dad's had a brain hemorrhage is because of the severe amount of stress he's been under. And I just remember them saying that and thinking, 6 months earlier, I was in intensive care and didn't even give it a second thought. That's why when I think you can be so consumed and so disconnected from yourself, that it's actually a really terrifying place to be, because you can be.
And also in an industry that it sounds like kind of encourages that in a way. At the time
they did, but at the time it was like this fast pace. And I mean, I was hyper grateful for what it did give me, because it also gave me an immense amount of confidence, connections, network, like a whole different life. But what I lost is I completely lost myself.
And then when you had this wake up call, what were the changes that you started to implement?
I'll be really honest, because I always find it really hard when I listen to people who have like gone through something and they give an answer. I'm like, great, I'm going to go and do all these things, because that's kind of how that person got to this place. I had no idea what my next step was. All I knew is that my body was suffering. And for me to kind of just support myself, just me without no mindset about work or anything, I needed to understand how that worked. And I need to understand, like, how do I look after myself? So the next kind of part of that was I applied for a Bachelor of Science to go and do a human nutrition degree to become a registered nutritionist. But so much of my life at school, as I hated school, I mean, I love the social element. The social element was like my best part, but the school itself, I absolutely detested learning because I just felt like I would always be kind of at the back, not really processing, understanding things correctly. And I always just thought I had really bad attention. But when I went back and I got into my nutritional science degree, within like the first week, my professor pulled me out of the class and I was like, oh God, this is going to be a moment where they're just like, you're just not cut out for this. And I remember feeling like quite removed because I'd kind of come from a kind of a New York high-flying world, sat into a classroom, kind of going, is this me? Am I meant to be doing this? You know, I kind of just didn't really know who I was. And she looked at me and she just said, look, I can feel that you're really struggling. And I was like, this is really odd. I've only been in class for like a week. How does this person know that I'm really struggling? I haven't said anything. And I'd handed in a paper. She noticed that so much of my wording was backwards. And she said, look, you're doing biochemistry. I think you're dyslexic, but this is going to be really difficult if you are, because it's very complex wording. And obviously the big thing with dyslexics is that you get everything mixed up.
Did you know you were dyslexic?
I had no idea. Mm. And so what I then went on was this like insane transformative journey. I mean, that was the first time in my entire life, by the way, I'd ever been seen. I ever felt seen. Someone had like watched me, saw me, bore me out and said, I can see you're struggling and something. And I remember when she said that to me, it was like this, it was such an emotional moment because I kind of couldn't grasp that I could be dyslexic. Like I got to 23, 24 and for the first time in a week, somebody had just said like, I can see. And then I went on this like 3-hour test and within 5 minutes, they were like, look, you're like extremely dyslexic. You were like the 1% severity of dyslexia. I was like, how have I got here being such an extreme dyslexic?
Well, I guess if you're going to get by in any industry without them noticing, it'll be the modelling industry.
Well, I mean, I still had to do my own accounts at 16. You know, like
painful.
Like being 16 and being self-employed and trying to find an accountant, like all of these things and like rents in 5 different countries. And, you know, there's like, it's weird because the fashion industry does shed this light that you're meant to be a bit stupid, but you're like a proper business person at the age of 16. I grew up quicker than anyone else I know because I
had to figure it out.
And I remember, and that took me on one of the biggest journeys because everyone says, well, you must be so resilient and so thick-skinned from the modeling industry. And yeah, I am, because I had so much shit to deal with. But I also think the biggest thing for me and understanding this now, especially in the last year of all the work that I've been doing and collaboratively the last 10 years that I've been doing, is that that was probably my most defining moment for me.
Finding out you were dyslexic.
Finding out I was dyslexic. Because for me, it made me understand that, so I naturally think I'm quite a confident person. I'm quite an extrovert. I really like being around people. But I always had this feeling of never being good enough because I was told my whole life that I wasn't good enough in, in
academia,
school.
Yeah.
I was always in the lowest sets. I had a brother and sister who were really intelligent, who'd just been top sets for everything. And they didn't work very hard, but they were just naturally very bright. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the bottom set for everything and kind of, and I remember I had glandular fever when I was 15 and they just said to me, we just don't think we're going to pass your GCSEs. And literally being told that as a child, you just don't feel good enough, especially against all of your peers. And then going into the modeling industry and again, kind of not being told in many ways, you are not good enough and you're constantly like fighting for survival. But I remember everyone in my life saying, why are you going back to do science? You were never good at school. And me and my brain going, oh God, what am I doing?
I love that you did do that though, because the way that our education system is structured, I think it's evolved quite a lot. But at the time, you know, I struggled a lot at school. And you speaking about it right now does make me think, oh yeah, that's probably where all those sort of complexes have come from.
All of them.
Of not feeling good enough, being scared to ask about something I don't understand in case I sound stupid because it's really straightforward and easy. Mm-hmm. And also having a mind that works in a slightly squiggly manner.
It's all about squiggles. It's all about squiggles.
My family's like linear thinkers, you know, they're like, you just go from here to here is what just straightforward. Why have you gone like out the back and around the world to get there? But it's just, you know, and it's, I think when you realize that it's a beautiful thing and to embrace it, but at the time there wasn't that perspective on it at all. It was sort of,
none.
You know, my stepdad always, he's dyslexic, and he said at my age you were just called thick.
Yeah, like, so I was called thick at my age. But it's true. And like, how detrimental is that? Because dyslexia has nothing to do with your IQ. And like, what I've realized is like, in my later years when I've embraced it, I've actually excelled in so many things because I know what my strengths are. But I don't know what my strengths are when I'm in a maths class and I'm like, I don't know what the square root of that is. Like, my brain doesn't work in that way. Yeah. And it's one of those things that if you don't get it, then get out. You know, it's one of those things that you can't embrace into a conversation because you said it's so linear. And I just remember her telling me that. And I mean, I got a first in my degree. I got one of the top grades in the country from a girl that was nearly going to drop out because she felt so left behind.
But did they support you a lot once you figured that out?
Hugely. Yeah.
Huge, and did it shift the whole experience of how you were learning, how you 100%. Were?
100%. I would never have got that grade that I did if they didn't support me. And it made me understand just my brain. I learn in colours. I learn in audio, hence why a podcast I love. You know, I would record my lecture and I wouldn't be listening in my lecture because I would get very overwhelmed and my processing just wasn't working. So I'd record everything. I'd go for a run. The movement, the running, the listening, listen to that on audio, I'd come back and I would just be able to disseminate the information like that in a block. And I'd do it into blocks of colours. And I remember walking into...
What's that look like more specifically?
I'd have these huge A3 pieces of paper and I'd have different rows of colours. And I would have each different mechanism or each different chemical structure that I was observing done in very segmented forms of different colours. So when I would try to understand any type of process, I would look at it in blocks and they would be in colour codes. And so I could visually bring them to the front of my brain very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I was looking at it on a PowerPoint, it was just black writing with a picture. And I would just be so, well, not just uninspired, but I just wouldn't process it. And so for me, I would need to listen to somebody's voice without looking at the writing. And so I would then imagine it in my own sense. And then I would come back and write that down. And that completely transformed how I learned, but also like how my energy was. Because I remember feeling so de-energized and so frustrated and so alone. Like, the alone concept was there as much as it was in the modeling world. I felt so detracted from everything because I just felt like, why can't I get this? You know, I felt... just felt really slow. And I just thought, God, there's got to be something wrong with my brain. Like, why does what the way I would describe it is like my brain actually hurt. Mm-hmm. And I would be like, why do I struggle? And then you look around everyone else and they're all just there, like writing away like this. And you would get a complex because you'd be like, well, I don't know what to write and I don't know what they're writing. What are they writing? And you would leave with a blank page. And then you'd sit at home and just stare at your screen and try and understand it. And so when I learned that way of learning for me, and like really small notes, for me, that's what really kind of excelled my learning. But then I just got really imaginative with it and creative with it and would put it into different contexts. And so for me, that was something that really helped. But I think understanding that was such a big block for me really helped me understand more about my sense of self, of all the triggers and all the worries I've got of my weaknesses, all the times when I would dumb myself down, all the times when I wouldn't want to go and do something because I'd be so afraid of being like found out. Mm-hmm. And that was basically just this ball of nerves that I'd have. And that was just built from complexes over the years of never feeling good enough or worthy enough in those moments. And, you know, that related to modeling. You know, I would be so terrified that I wouldn't be successful in that job that I would then have to go and do something else. And all of these complexes just kind of drove one another, all of these worries and all of these triggers. And it, you know, I still get these moments now. I still will be on a show and be terrified of saying someone's name wrong or interpreting something in a in a more of a different way and being a little bit terrified about how that person might react. But actually, you just have to embrace it. And I think that's such a big thing. Whereas before, it would just hold me back. And I think we all have those things. But I think for me, the dyslexia was so deep.
Yeah. And then once you got that first, then what did you do after that?
So it was really interesting because I knew when I was studying, I wasn't like, I want to become and go and do a PhD and be a researcher and be stuck behind books, because that just also isn't me. But I really wanted to understand the science around human nutrition. And then I went on and looked a bit at the psychology of eating disorders, because for me, my vision was, I want to first of all go back into the industry and be a bit of a speaker and not campaigner, that's not the word, but a bit of an advocate. And,
yeah.
But don't forget, like, all of this now sounds like quite a linear, normal route. But back then, I don't know anyone that studied nutrition. Like, I remember going in and them going, so you study nutrition and then you go into band one if you want to go in to do any kind of work in hospitals, or you want to go and do an extra year of dietetics. And then you'll start on like £20,000 a year. Then after 2 years, you might go to band two, and that's what this looks like. And it was a very like formulaic response. And I was like, I don't want to go into that. I really want to take the information, disseminate it, and help to try and relay this to people to encourage them more on the preventative side. I didn't want people to go down this route that I went to. And I mean, I hit rock bottom at like the complete extreme at a super young age. I feel like a lot of people have these stories around midlife, but I feel like I had it hyper early in my 20s.
You're talking about when you ended up in hospital.
Yeah. And I never wanted people to go down this confusing route of health, because I remember back then I was looking for help.
Yeah.
But nobody, apart from the NHS, which you don't go to for preventative care, it was all quite marketing in this wellness bubble. There was nothing that was like authoritative, but also inspirational and empowering that I related to. So I was like, I really want to come back with something that is going to give this to people. And for me, that was having to understand the science first, because if you don't, it can be quite toxic to people, that you can take them down the road that I went down.
Yeah.
Because we're all so individual. And I think that is like such a key part that I figured out. And that's why I rarely talk about how I live my life. Because
it's so personal.
It's so personal. And we're all such complex humans. And that's why when I see patients in clinic, you know, our first session is over an hour and a half. And we go so deep into things. And every single individual that's come out, they never have the same plan because they're all so different. And I think it's so easy to Google something and kind of go, I'm going to try this extreme diet, or I'm going to try this product. But actually, there's so much complexity that comes with that. And so for me, a lot of this was, okay, I want to go back into the industry first of all and help a lot of these kind of young people coming up into this industry and give them some support and work with the agencies and work with the agents and try and really understand a procedure that we can implement to support mental health and physical health. And then kind of through that, like my own development, I was just developing myself. And so after the Be Well, for me, a lot about this was bringing the podcast to life, like actually having these conversations, knowing the top scientists that are out there and bringing them onto the show and helping inspire people on their journey.
And taking it out of just the model industry and making it accessible to everyone. I'm curious to know, was there resistance from the model industry initially? Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Huge. I mean, there was resistance from everyone. Like even my parents, like no one spoke about this, you know, like having this type of conversation was really, really difficult.
But what type of conversation?
Anything around mental health and anything around nutritional health. Like my dad was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, I don't know, about 9 years ago now. And I was studying at the time, and I was obviously learning all about how insulin resistance happens from a high load of carbohydrates, and there's loads of lifestyle factors that go along with that, and actually how with the right diet you can actually help reverse type 2 diabetes. And I remember even trying to have a conversation with my dad, and it was so freaking painful.
Was it just dismissed?
Completely dismissed.
But I guess that's because as well, you know, when you go to the doctor, I don't like going to the doctor, but they don't ask you about your nutrition or what your diet's like. So would you be able to, you know, you just said that you can actually help diabetes by diet. What are some of the things that you studied and discovered and were kind of blown away by in terms of the connection with nutrition and diet and things that people just take as, oh, well, I've got this and I can't do anything about it?
Probably most illnesses. But the thing that I got, I mean, diabetes was something that was very close to my heart because of my father. And we did take him off medication and we did reverse it. And that for him was quite mind-blowing. And it was one of the most painful experiences of my life. Working with a family member and trying to tell them what to do is like not something that I would advocate to do for everyone unless you've got a really good relationship. But for me, the biggest area where my research has gone down is mental health and diet. And that's why I'm so passionate about these two things, because I started off looking at dyslexia, autism, and ADHD. And that's where like my fascination in mental health grew, because the first part of my dissertation that I looked at, and this is so long ago now, but obviously ADHD is quite a common conversation these days, whereas back then it wasn't, is that I really wanted to look at, okay, well, I'm dyslexic. How can I help my dyslexia apart from the conventional methods of learning? And I really wanted to look at like what nutrition can maybe help with the formation with the dyslexia in the brain. And I looked at fish and I wanted to see whether having more oily fish, which is basically 25% of your cell membrane. So if you think about this as like bricks in the wall, and you think every third brick is an omega-3, which is a fatty acid, but it's a longer chain omega-3. So you only get it in fish, which is DHA. So you have like your walnuts and chai seeds that you might see have omega-3, but they're these shorter chains, which don't convert down to these longer chains. So if you think about every third brick, okay, that's your DHA. Now, if I take that brick away, every third brick, and a storm comes, what do you think happens?
Wool falls down.
That's what our cell membrane is. So we have these fatty acids, 25% is made up of this DHA. Now, we need to replenish that. If we don't have enough oily fish in our diet, what happens is, you know, our bodies are super clever. They'll just take another type of fat, like a cholesterol, and they'll just shove it in there. So it's then like kind of shoving in something else into that brick that's not a solid brick. Maybe it's like some tissue paper or something else just to kind of like cement that hole, but it's not going to be a strong foundation. And things like cholesterol, they're much more rigid and not as fluid in structure. And so what we know is that when I was looking at this, dyslexics that were given oily fish, especially children, overcame their processing reading age and their chronological reading age.
No way.
Just by having oily fish. So I started like looking at this. I started looking at Alex Richardson, who is a professor at Oxford, and understanding more. She's kind of dedicated a lot of her studies to dyslexia, especially in children. And then I was like, well, what happens with pregnant mums? I mean, this is part of my dyslexia. I was like, well, what happens if we just keep going down this chain? So I remember calling my mum and saying, Mum, what was my, my mum doesn't mind me talking about this in podcast, but I was like, what was your pregnancy like with me? And she was like, you were like a demon child. I couldn't eat anything. I was sick all the time. I'd only live on crusty bread. So I was like, what happens in the development of the brain in the womb? And in the third trimester, it's when the baby's brain's developed. And we know that it's so important for women to have oily fish in that third trimester. And if they don't, there's a real association with women having children that have learning disabilities like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, because they're not getting enough of this DHA in their bodies as women to give to their children, which is part of their brain development. So you really start going, oh my gosh, nutrition is so critical to our mental health.
But is dyslexia not just a different way of thinking as opposed to being sort of malnourished?
Yeah, it's also genetically linked as well. So there's also that. So it's not the sole reason, but we know that the having nutrients that support our mental health and dyslexia or learning disabilities are critical. So knowing if you've got maybe a dyslexic child or an autistic child, knowing that you can actually help with certain nutrients doesn't mean it's going to cure it, doesn't mean it's going to make it easier, but can really help support that cell membrane structure is critical. Because when what you're doing is compromising it for no reason. But a lot of people don't actually try to think, well, why is this so important? Well, actually, our bodies need fuel. Our brain needs specific type of nutrients. And if 25% of our cell membrane is made up of that, that's a really critical component.
So you're saying from the studies of pregnant women that you could see a connection between children that had learning difficulties and their diet during pregnancy?
With dyslexia, yeah.
With dyslexia. But then is dyslexia a genetic predisposition?
Can be. So I think the nuance of the conversation here is there's a lot of associations, which is different to causations. So everything with learning disabilities, with autism, ADHD, dyslexia, they're all multifactorial. So a lot of it has a genetic link. A lot of it can have links from when you're pregnancy, especially in your third trimester. A lot of it can have links with how you're nourished as a child. All of these things play into the interim of the context of the situation.
And environment, I'm sure.
Environment, a really, really big one. But that's what I found fascinating, right? I was like, okay, well, I know I've got this, but how else could I help myself? Then speaking to my mum about understanding how she was pregnant with me was such a big kind of realization. I was like, well, my mum didn't eat anything. I mean, she lost so much weight and she was so sick and all of her teeth fell out because she was so ill with me. She wasn't getting any nutrients. And I think now she would have been kind of taken into hospital. But back then, they didn't really understand the importance around that. And so just I remember kind of looking into this, and this was about 10 years ago when I looked at this. So it could have changed. But a lot of the research around them was that there are huge links with nutrition in this sector. And there's a lot that you can do to support yourself. And I also think that's a really positive lens, because it's like, well, what else can you do to support yourself? Well, this is one thing that you can try. And I think what's really important here is just saying this isn't the sole answer, but it's one piece of the puzzle. And what that then led me down is, okay, well, I now understand a bit about dyslexia. I can now see that there's definitely links on how nutrition and mental health can go hand in hand. How else can it go hand in hand? And then around that time, maybe it was just before, a trial called the SMILES trial came out, which was the first ever trial. So we're going on to a different sector of mental health, but the first ever trial that was released, which looked at people that had chronic depression. So they were chronically depressed, not just a bit of low mood, they were chronic depressed. And they basically split them into two groups. They had the modified Mediterranean diet, but a lot higher quantities of the foods. And then they had a social support group. And so they wanted to see what happened. And what they found is, at the end of that trial, is that the people in the support group, they did see an improvement, but it was a very, very small percentage. But they did see that it did help. But the people that were in the modified Mediterranean diet, so the high amounts of Mediterranean diet type of food, it was like a third of them, or maybe it was two thirds, it was a really high percentage, overcame and went into remission for depression. Pure remission.
And for those that don't know, would you be able to explain what the Mediterranean diet consists of?
The base of it is kind of whole grains, pulses, beans, that type of thing. And then it's layered on with a bit of meat and a bit of fish. And then it's kind of olive oil is trickled all the way through. And the base of it is vegetables, legumes, greens. So predominantly plant-based with a little bit of meat, a little bit of fish in there, and lots of olive oil. That's the typical Mediterranean diet. Now, the modified Mediterranean diet was kind of ranked up a lot more. So I think it was something between 5 and 8 portions of like whole grains a day. So it was a lot. There's a lot of food to consume. But basically, because it was so much food to consume, it basically took out all of the processed foods. Because when you're eating that much whole food, you naturally take out the processed foods. Yeah. So there was very limited processed food in their diet. But what I found really, really interesting is that was the first ever study. It was a SMILES trial done by Professor Felice Jacka from the Food and Mood Center. It was phenomenal. That was the first diet that actually showed that chronic depression could be reversed, could go into remission. And so that was such a pioneering study of the moment. And I think that really opened the doors into nutrition and mental health. A real link to what the Mediterranean diet kind of shows, and what that did show, is that a lot of this also works in the gut microbiome. So when you're thinking about the amount of pulses, the amount of fiber that's in that diet, the amount of prebiotic foods, they're all working with our gut health. And so when we start looking into our gut health, that's where our neurotransmitters are made, which is like our serotonin, our dopamine, all of these feel-good hormones that are really important for our mental health, all made within our gut. And we know that we have this gut-brain connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that 90% of our neurotransmitters are sent up to our brain. But we also know that 10% of our brain health, of how we're feeling, goes into our gut. So every time we're stressed, we have this bi-directional connection. And so that's why people that might have IBS or IBD suffer more so with anxiety and depression.
Right. So they're feeding into each other.
They're feeding into one another.
What are some of your observations at the clinic of people at the moment in today's world that you would, that you've observed are problematic in terms of their diet and relationship to food? Actually, let's start with just their diet.
There has been a huge rise in nutrition over the last 10 years. I mean, from when I started studying it and nobody cared about it and no one wanted to talk about it to now it kind of becoming the forefront of a conversation, whether you're at like a dinner party or whether it's kind of a founder wanting to kind of execute more on their workload and wanting to know what to eat, or whether it's somebody wanting to eat to help their hair or whatever it is. There's a multitude of reasons of why people are talking about nutrition, because we're really understanding how important it is to our health, physically, mentally, and emotionally. And I think we now know that when we don't eat well, we tend to feel worse. Mm-hmm. So that kind of emphasis on mental health has really started to shone through. But one of the biggest things that for me really stands out is still this disconnection. So I see a lot of people wanting to try and eat really, really, really well, but becoming really derailed by mismarketing of foods that are out there. So they think I'm eating really, really healthily because this is what the marketing label is telling me.
Yeah.
But there, it's the complete opposite. And so I'm seeing a lot of that where people just feel like they're hitting a brick wall all the time and they're just hyper confused around it. The biggest thing I can say to people is, if I say to the, so actually, let's do this together. How many processed foods do you think you eat?
I don't know. A few.
How would you define a processed food?
Something that's not natural.
Okay.
Something that's a bit, I've never really thought about it, to be honest.
But would you say you're quite healthy?
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm not that puristic about food.
So it's interesting, right? The dynamics there is, I'm not that puristic, but to be that, I've got to be really healthy.
What do you mean to be?
So there's this kind of like ideal of having to eat this really clean diet.
Yeah,
to
and feel that's really healthy. Yeah.
And that's healthy. And it's not, because that's also unhealthy. Trying to feel that you need to eat this like very clean way is also not a really healthy relationship with food. So a lot of people also feel there's a massive barrier to eating well because it can feel very elitist at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I think the biggest way to break it down is trying to understand how much nutrition you're getting in your diet, like how many just whole foods. It doesn't have to be clean, but it can be like a can of beans. These are the things that make up staples of our diet. But with the rise in nutrition, it's also become increasingly complex. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot of the frustration that comes through my door. People are just confused about what the hell they're meant to be doing, when actually, in simple terms, it's really not meant to be that confusing. It's meant to actually be quite simple. But we've made this thing into something that's so complex because there's so many voices on social media
that conflict with each other.
That conflict with one another. And so people are like, I don't know what I'm meant to be doing, so I just give up. And that's what I end up seeing. And then also we get these kind of really mixed marketing messages on the fastest way to lose weight, the top 10 boosters for your skin health, the top 10 supplements to take for your hair health, the top 10 ways to de-bloat. And all of that is nothing that's kind of aligned with where you are right now.
Yeah.
And so people are trying to do these things and becoming these really overwhelmed in the way on the process and then give up.
Because I guess I'm someone that, like, you know, I eat intuitively, but that was a very foreign concept for me for a lot of my life.
Yeah.
So within that, I'll eat whatever I want. But I also know that if I'm eating something that's quote unquote unhealthy, I won't have like a huge amount of it. And that's totally fine. It doesn't really disrupt my system in any capacity. Mm. But before I had this sort of feast or famine where I would be like, I can't have those kind of things in the house because I'll eat the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then I would have something like that and I would eat the whole thing. And then I would feel really bloated and like awful. And then it created this sort of chain reaction that was deeply unhealthy. Mm-hmm. But again, it was because I was trying to abide by all these rules of like, okay, bread's bad for you. Okay, I won't have bread. You know, all the stuff mm-hmm. which I realized now is just absolute rubbish. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think if you're feeling good in yourself and it's working for you, then like, you know, each to their own.
Mm. But a lot of that also kind of aligns with a destructive behavior. Food is so easy to kind of be the armor in that.
Yeah.
It's so easy.
To be the armor in it or to be the weapon.
Well, yeah, maybe that's a better way of putting it. I was thinking of it that it can kind of it can kind of come on as your force to protect you, so it doesn't show that you're being as destructive. It's a very easy way to kind of hide the self-destructive behavior because mm-hmm. people don't really see you do it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the relationship that you have with yourself during that time. And that's why it becomes so complex. It's not always the food that's the issue. It's the way
you're relating to it.
It's the worthiness that you have with yourself. It's the self-kindness that you have for yourself. That's such a big area. The self-compassion and the self-kindness is such a big interlink when it comes to food.
Well, within that, because obviously, you know, you've said you have people that come to see you and they're sort of hitting their head against a brick wall and they're like, oh, I've tried all of these things, it's not working. Do you get into the sort of nuts and bolts of what's going on in their psychology?
I think one of the biggest things that I've learned, and I think, yeah, so much about food is not just telling somebody what they should be eating or trying to navigate them through what they should be eating. So much about it is understanding their relationship to self.
Mm-hmm. But why is that such an untapped area as it relates to our body? Because it's huge.
It's huge. I don't know why there is. It's so unspoken about, but it's something that I've really started to see within myself and my own journey, within my patients and their own journey, but also just within the research. There's a very limited amount of research around self-compassion and food. And there's a lot that goes into kind of disordered eating, body satisfaction, body dissatisfaction, body image. But there's a very limited area of research around self-compassion to self and self-kindness and self-worthiness. And I think, one, it has to be done in a very individual approach. Two, it's quite terrifying to start understanding that relationship.
Unraveling it, yeah.
It's terrifying. But I think it's one of the biggest things, especially when it comes to food. So much comes down to how we see ourselves. We're never taught about this. It's something that we kind of go through our journey ourselves of having to understand how to be kind to ourselves. Quite easy to be told how we can be kind to one another and how I can mm-hmm. be kind to you, but it's quite hard for me to understand how to be kind to myself unless I think that I'm really worthy of it. Mm. And that unravels something completely different. And when we look at how people talk to oneself, and this is something that I've become really interested in, there's a lot of conversation around gratitude at the moment, and there's a lot of conversation around positive self-talk. And I've always been really interested in that, but never really understood like the scientific lens on it. And I always want to know, you know, is this just something that is meant to make us feel good, but or is it going to really have an effect? And there was a study, it was completely randomized, where they put two sets of groups on a running machine on a treadmill test. And then they came off and they said to them, you've got the gene that's really good for endurance, and made them feel that they were really good at endurance running because they've got the specific gene. They said to the other group, remember, this is completely randomized, it's not true. Said to this other group, you don't have the gene for endurance running, so you're not very good at it. They got them back on the treadmill test. The ones that were told that they had the endurance gene, which again, they didn't because it was randomized, outperformed their personal best from the first time, but also outperformed the other group. The group that were told that they didn't have the endurance gene went back on the treadmill and underperformed. So just by simply telling them a statement that isn't true, but that was more positive, they outperformed. And they gave that same group again, but again, completely randomized. They said to one of them, okay, you've got an FTO gene, which means that they've got more of a predisposition to obesity, but they didn't have it, but they said that to them. And they said to the other group, you don't have that FTO gene. And then they gave those groups these meals, and they both reacted completely differently in their hormonal response.
Whoa.
Just from them thinking that they had that gene.
So are you sort of, the hormonal response was that of the one that was told that they did have the gene would be more inclined to put on weight because mm-hmm. of the hormonal response.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's wild. Isn't that wild?
So obviously, you know, the nature of this show and myself is along the more woo-woo side of things. So I've always thought this must play a huge part because I also know in my own experience, in my own body, how it has, how my self-talk has impacted my body mm-hmm. for over years. But I've never been able to fully understand or speak to anyone about it. And it sounds really like, oh, if you speak to yourself in a certain way. But if you take that particular story and think about, you know, what I was saying, when we get into that quite destructive cycle, for every person that might be listening to this that has that situation where they start eating something that they've given a morality piece to. Mm-hmm. So they've labeled it as bad, right? And they start eating it and they start feeling that thought in their head of, oh my God, I'm going to put on loads of weight from having this. Are you suggesting that even having those negative thoughts is therefore going to predetermine the fact that you will therefore be, which it kind of is, right?
Well, what these studies show is that it does change your physiology. So it does have an impact.
What these thoughts and these beliefs. Thoughts,
yeah. It changes your performance. It changes the physiology that's in your body. And so much about how we talk to ourselves is fundamental. Because if we talk to ourselves in a negative way, yes, okay, those are scientific studies that can show that it can have an effect in our body from how we metabolize food to how we perform in a race. But also, you're just constantly telling yourself negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly telling yourself you're not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was like what I was like in the modeling industry. I was constantly told
berating that yourself.
I wasn't great. Yeah. That's what I was told at school. I was constantly told that I wasn't smart enough. And it completely broke me. The science does show that that is a really important element just from how you're eating and just from how you're performing. But we don't speak about that in society. So if you're telling yourself every day, I didn't eat well today.
Mm-hmm.
I let myself go today. You're constantly putting a cap on that self-kindness. You're not letting any room for error appear. You're becoming like your harshest critic every day. And having that heavy element of not feeling worthy because you haven't done something perfect every single day. You've maybe had an off day or an off week or an off month. There's no room for that growth
mm-hmm.
into that long-term thought perspective of what you want your goals around nutrition to be, of what you want your goals around exercise to be.
But I think this sort of irony of the whole thing is that actually when you master or begin to practice the self-compassion piece, the other stuff doesn't really matter because you don't really care. Because, you know, you might... because you're like, I feel a little bit squishy today. Okay, like, you know, it doesn't... You take that pressure off because that's no longer the goal.
Totally.
And then you have a more harmonious relationship with yourself consequently because of that.
Yeah. You learn to live more in self-kindness when you get to that space, more in acceptance of yourself. And I think as long as there's an understanding of what your body and mind needs, right? We do need good nourishing food. Like we do need that to feel well. But as long as there's an understanding of, I want to feed my body to support it well, taking that harsh critic off is one of the best things that you'll do for your health.
And what would your advice be for anyone listening that is struggling with that self-talk right now be?
I think it's one of the hardest ones to give a really specific, easy answer to
mm-hmm.
because everyone's going to be on a completely different stage of that. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the biggest things that I would say to anyone who's struggling with that self-talk is first just try and write a list of like the 10 things that you love about yourself and try and keep them on your phone. Try and keep them, stick them on your mirror if you live on your own or you're not afraid of someone seeing them. And I think it's trying to constantly remind yourself of those things that you love about yourself, because the only things that are going to stay in your mind are the things that you hate about yourself or the negative comments. If 3 good things happen in your day and 3 bad things happen in your day, you'll probably remember the 3 bad things. Mm-hmm. You'll very rarely remember the 3 good things. And we know that for every bad comment made, we need 3 positive ones to balance it out. And so if you think about that logically, for every bad thing that you hear, you need 3 positive ones. Mm-hmm. So it is a practice of telling yourself the things that you love about yourself. But when you're in that negative state, it's so hard to bring that up. So hard to think about it, because all you can think about is that negative lens. And so having those things written down somewhere, I think is really important. And I say 10, you can do as many as you want. But for some people, that can be really, really hard just to write a couple down. And then within that, and it's something that I think has been so misconstrued in society right now, but it's adding in your own time for self-care, which I think has become a language that's become a spa day, or, you know, going to get your nails done or having a bath. It's actually taking something which brings you complete peace and joy. And I think sometimes I say to people, what does bring you like joy in a moment that's free? And some people really, really struggle to answer that question. And it's because we've completely lost that understanding of what's really important for us. But we need those moments. We need them every day, and we need them in our day to help us keep going. So I'd also write down the 5 things that you feel actually bring you a lot of joy and happiness that don't involve finance. And it's going to be a journey, right? It's not going to be one of those things where in 2 weeks you've lost your negative self-talk. I still get negative self-talk.
But it's just about catching it when it happens, because most people are going around with it all the time in their heads and then being like, I don't know why I'm feeling like shit, because they haven't acknowledged the impact that that voice is having.
But I do think when you're especially not in that specific negative self-talk, starting the work on this then.
Mm-hmm.
But it's building in, it's building that habit. And it's really, really hard, but it's like trying to build a new highway. So at the moment, you've got one highway that's kind of rooted in this negative self-talk, and it's there, it's quite a firm structure. And you know, when any maintenance is done on a road, any road works, it takes so long for this new highway to be built.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you've got to think about it as. You're building this new highway. And it's not going to be done in a day, and it's not going to be done in a month, but it's going to take continuous work to build that stretch. But the more that you do it, the more that you'll have that neuroplasticity working to build that new highway.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I think that's kind of all we have time for today. But Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. I love this, and I think our audience are going to get a lot from this episode. So thank you for your insight.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Saturn Returns and for your continued support of the podcast. If you haven't followed the show yet, please hit the follow button. And if you feel so inclined to do so, please share this episode on social media or with a friend who you think might find it useful. As always, remember, you are not alone. Goodbye.